Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dean Radin. Dean is Chief Scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and Associated Distinguished Professor of Integral and Transpersonal Psychology at the California Institute of Integral Sciences. He has degrees in electrical engineering, physics, and psychology, and has been involved in research on the frontiers of consciousness for over 30 years. Dean is the author of many scientific papers, book chapters, and books, including Supernormal, The Conscious Universe, and Real Magic. Dean's work opens up the possibility for the unification of science and spirituality through the lens of quantum mechanical principles. His work on how conscious attention and intention impact quantum-level events is paving the way for our understanding of our role in the unfolding of the world around us. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share deep dives into topics like this. It's the best way to support me and the podcast while also getting my in-depth thoughts about these topics. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Dean, thank you so much for giving me some of your time today. I've been persistent in trying to get you on the podcast, so it's really such an honor to get to speak with you today.
It's my pleasure to be here, finally.
So I wanted to start by asking you about the IONS position statement. So IONS is where you are the chief scientist and doing all of your work. And you want to start with the idea that consciousness is fundamental. And I guess I want to get an understanding of why choose that as a starting point. How do we get there as a starting point?
Well, we consider it a working hypothesis, right? We don't know that this is the case, but what we do know is that the only things that we will ever know comes through our awareness of it. It sounds almost like a tautology, like what you can know is what you can know. Well, we know things through our conscious awareness. So from that perspective, we can also say then that everything else that we know, everything else in science, all of our perceptions, everything is being filtered in some way through our conscious awareness, through consciousness. Well, then you would think it would be probably important for us to understand better what consciousness is and also what it's capable of. And so the last part of that comes about because we're ultimately talking about experiences that people have, and there's a huge range of experiences. Everyday types of experiences we deal with things like academic psychology, sociology, things like that. But what then do we do with experiences that don't seem to fit very well into the rest of what we understand from science? So we focus on experiences that are called psychic and mystical, channeling, out-of-body experience, all of those kinds of things, because from a standard scientific perspective, and by that I mean a materialistic philosophy perspective, all that we can think about those is that they must be either illusions or delusions, despite the fact that they happen pretty often. And more importantly, when they do happen to people, they tend to be transformative in the sense that the person's previous ideas about who and what they are often changed dramatically and permanently. And even more important is that when these kinds of unusual experiences happen, they tend to become, the person becomes more pro-social. That means that they become more compassionate, more empathetic. They all of their personality moves into a direction where, just in a general sense, you can say they become a better human being. So that too tells us that we had better understand more about what is it then about these kinds of experiences that create people who are actually better than they were before. Better is maybe a loaded term, but I think you know what I mean. They become pro-social, which is good for the fabric of civilization. So those are some of the reasons why we're interested in this. My own personal reason is largely driven by scientific curiosity, because I was trained in conventional science and went through traditional educational programs up through my doctorate and worked in industry and for the U.S. government doing standard scientific stuff. And nowhere in my educational business or anywhere along the line was it ever mentioned about how to think about these unusual experiences. And so then as a scientist, I put on my scientist hat, I'm thinking, well, what was left out? Something interesting must have been left out of the whole educational program. And not only was it left out, but why was it left out? Because science aspires to study everything freely. Well, it took years to figure out that that's not the case, that science studies a whole bunch of different things, but it doesn't deal very well with what we can think of as our internal world. It studies the outside world, the world is seen from the outside, but not so much the inside. Then you start looking at other cultures. You look at Eastern culture as an example of where the inner space is studied to a much greater degree, not more, but certainly much more so than in a Western sense, studies inner space rather than outer space. And different models of reality come about. And interestingly, those models are not incompatible with psychic and mystical and other kinds of states. So, this was, again, not part of standard education. I have to kind of learn it on my own. But once you do open up and look at other ways of considering reality, then it becomes even much more interesting. And it doesn't take anything away from science. It just says there's a more comprehensive way of understanding how things work, in which case science becomes a special case. It's really good at what it does, but it's not the whole story.
You picked sort of consciousness as really the key thing you want to hone in on. And it seems like the most difficult thing we could possibly try and understand. So I admire you for that. And something that I've been thinking about for a long time is it actually possible to truly understand consciousness from the position of a human being? And I've often thought it's probably impossible for us to truly grasp what consciousness is from our perspective. And I was wondering what you think about that. Can we ever really get a grasp on it from where we are?
It's tempting to never say never, but I completely understand what you're saying, that we are ourselves trying to see ourselves. And so it's like the eye trying to look back at itself. And we can kind of do that through a mirror, but we can't do it directly. So it is a challenge. And I like that challenge. That's one of the reasons why I've stayed in this field for so long, because the challenge itself is kind of a puzzle too. So how can we figure out ways, can we be clever enough to examine consciousness from the inside, but using the tools from the outside? So you can certainly, if you're a meditator or you take psychedelics or whatever, you can study these things from the inside. Then it becomes really difficult not only to share what you've learned with somebody else other than telling them stories, but oftentimes the language doesn't work. This is the reason why a mystic will have an experience where they feel like they're one with the universe, and then they'll come back and people will say, oh, tell us what happened. And they'll say, I can't, because there are no words to describe that. It's not part of everyday reality. So I think it's valuable for the person who has that experience, and may even be inspirational for others to hear about the experience, but it doesn't really help everyone that much. We may need to have that internal experience directly. And so I think of other cultures, like in ancient Greece, they would have the mystery schools, where everyone, including at the time slaves, would be part of the mystery school, which is pretty democratic. And the mystery school process was teaching about the ultimate nature of reality for each person, and included psychedelics. So it was a way of pushing people into a mystical state. And we don't know exactly what there are theories about what psychedelics were being used, but we don't know exactly. But that's an interesting civilization. That means that they recognize that, yeah, there's certainly a lot of things in the outside world that we need to pay attention to, but the inside is also important. And a case can be made that one of the reasons why the Greek civilization was as advanced as it was in many ways, was because people did get a better sense of who they were on the inside.
It makes a lot of sense to think that if you understand that your actions impact others, that you will have a more cohesive sort of society. And Something that you made clear in your book, Real Magic, was that it seems like everyone has sort of minute capacities for things like precognition and telepathy to a certain extent when, you know, we're not very good at it, but it's there. But some people are really good at it. I recall hearing Rupert Sheldrake talk about one of his boys getting 20 out of 20 times with the sense of being stared at. He got it every single time. So some people are a bit more attuned to it. And I wonder if there are things about in the modern world that are perhaps dulling our abilities to engage with these things that, you know, we see in a lot of animals. They have the ability to sort of perceive things that we would think, you know, we would understand how they perceive them. But, you know, we're really not that different from them. And perhaps we have the same capacities. They've just been dulled. Is this something that you'd thought about with the modern world?
Oh, yeah. It's these things, yeah. Right? I mean, we're surrounded by distractions all the time, constantly, just the demands of everyday life and getting worse because, like, I'm on Zoom hours a day. Yeah. And so that's fun. It's a kind of a connection with other people and doing things and so on. But it means that the amount of time that I can spend simply contemplating, like, who and what am I and what am I here and what am I doing and all that is limited. And so if you take all of that and you then combine it into what are we actually sensitive to? What can we be sensitive to? Probably all kinds of things. But as you said, we're distracted from it. So even with that being said, there are people who have talent. And the people with talent in these domains, they didn't practice to get there. They're just good at it naturally. And so they have the same kind of distractions as everybody else, but they seem to be able to have better access to these sorts of things. Some people may not even realize that until they start to meditate or they take a psychedelic and then they realize, oh, that's what I can do. And others don't know that what they're doing is actually quite remarkable because they don't have anything to compare it against until they start talking to their friends. And the friends will start saying, you're crazy because we don't see that. We don't experience that. And so you learn pretty quickly to just not talk about it. So the idea of talent is interesting in this context because there are a lot of folklore everywhere in the world about people in families who seem to have these kinds of sensitivities. And the sensitivities typically are things like knowing what is happening to a family member at a distance or having precognitive dreams or something of that sort. And because it runs in families, it raises the possibility that there could be a genetic component, that something is inherited, just like other kinds of talents tend to be inherited. And also maybe because the people in that family have that skill, that it's not taboo to talk about it. So there's two different reasons why the ability might be pushed. And so one of the projects that we're interested in is looking at whether there is a genetic component using modern genetic tools to see if we can find what we're calling the psi gene. So it is almost certainly not a gene. It's probably a constellation of genes. But we have some evidence already at this point that that is probably the case, that there's some constellation of genes that give rise to people who have better intuition and maybe psychic abilities.
What would these genes be doing? How would they contribute to, you know, an increased perception of these things like telepathy and precognition?
Yeah, we don't know yet. That's why it's an interesting study. What we do know already from other studies is that things like intelligence are known to have constellation of genes that lead not only to superior intelligence, but different kinds of intelligence. So a type called fluid intelligence is associated with superior creativity, whereas crystalline intelligence is more like analytical or mathematical skills. And we know people have talents in those domains, and it turns out that there are hundreds of genes that contribute to not only the superior intelligence, but also splitting in those directions. So once you're dealing with hundreds of genes interacting, it's very complicated to say this is what they're doing because the brain and body are just ridiculously complex. But the fact that you can find those differences is interesting because it means, once again, that there's a genetic basis for things that we would have thought of as being so subtle that it couldn't possibly be embedded in your body somehow, but it turns out that it is.
I know Rupert Sheldrake tried, you know, in his theories about morphogenesis, has invoked, you know, a yet-to-be-identified field, a morphogenetic field, to explain the problem of morphogenesis, you know, not being able to be figured out on the genetic basis alone. And a lot of people say there's no need to invoke a new field that we can't interact with yet. There's no need. We shouldn't be trying to invoke new fields. Do you think that the invocation of a new yet-to-be-discovered field is something that we might need to consider for a phenomenon like this?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we do it all the time in science. People are always coming up with new particles and fields and forces and whatever. And it's simply part of the expansion of knowledge. Because if we stopped and we didn't even allow that to happen, or we thought it wasn't correct in some way, then science as we currently know it would become dogma. It would coagulate and not advance. And so part of this has to do with a kind of a personality difference you see among scientists. That some are convinced already that we're very close to actually understanding the way the universe works and ourselves. And others, like myself, are saying, we are so far away from that. We're just barely beginning to understand a few very simple things. So if somebody says the brain is the most complicated object in the universe, my reaction to that is that's just stupid. We have no idea what's going on even outside of our own planet, other than a few things that we picked up through astrophysics. We don't know. So my view is that we are somewhat clever primates who have been operating in a more or less human fashion for maybe 300,000 years or something like that. And using scientific methods, we've learned quite a bit about aspects of the material world for maybe a few hundred years, 500 years at most. We probably have forgotten what previous civilizations knew, a lot of it. And so to imagine at this point that we actually know who and what we are and the way that the world works is really just arrogance. Or maybe it's fear of not being comfortable with ambiguity or something. So Rupert and myself and most of my colleagues are very humble about what we think we know at this point. My own approach to all of this is as an empiricist. So I use the best tools that we know of in science to experimentally ask questions of the universe and then interpret the results that we get back. And so we do an experiment that is asking a question of the universe. Sometimes we get the question wrong. So we get a result, but maybe we don't understand it because we didn't ask the question correctly. So it's an interactive process, and we hope we get better and better at it over time and that we're interpreting the results correctly. And we've learned a few things. And we know that we've learned a few things because we're able to do an interview from one side of the earth to the other using video, as we are currently doing now. So this provides us with pragmatic evidence that we're on the right path in certain ways. But there's an infinity of other things that we don't understand yet.
Speaking about genetics, I wanted to ask you about whether you had any thoughts or opinions of the work of Garriev and Poponen with the DNA phantom effect back in the late 80s, early 90s. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard of it, and I've been looking for someone to repeat that and show that it's an effect that others can also pick up, and I haven't found very many. I mean, I'm not tracking it closely, so maybe I've missed something. But yeah, I would love to see somebody really pursue that rigorously and find out if that's really real, because if it is, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems if it is real, our understanding of DNA and genetic material might have to be shifted a little bit, because we really, if that's true, we really don't understand what it's exactly doing and whether it all comes down to base pairs or whether there's other things going on.
Sure. I'm still completely amazed that all living things on Earth are made out of DNA. The DNA is slightly different in each case, but it's relatively simple. I mean, it probably isn't so simple, but what we've seen so far, it's a coding system. Well, you know, how did that come about? Well, maybe after millions and millions of years, it would self-assemble into something like that. But it is astonishing that most life, all life actually on Earth, comes out of this same code.
Yeah, it's baffling. And I think that's why panspermia is actually such an intriguing idea. I know it just pushes the problem back. But you can see why it's such an appealing sort of answer to this problem.
Yeah.
Carl Jung often spoke about the collective unconscious. And I feel like the work you're doing sort of connects with these ideas of this sort of connection between everyone. And these collective movements, these in thought, in social movements, and so forth. Have you considered that maybe some of the work that has been done in this area sort of validates some of the ideas that Carl Jung had?
In a sense, yes. All psychic phenomena involve interactions of different types. So interactions between people, between living systems, there is an interconnectedness. I mean, it's all about, in a sense, sharing some aspects of subjectivity are shared. That's what telepathy and all that's about. But also interacting in a physical sense, the psychokinetic side, that something about our intentions and attentions are also felt by others, by other objects as well. So the closest that we have for, let me back up. So in most of what we look at in psychic phenomena are individuals and other people or other objects. That's how the vast majority of laboratory work goes. And that's what gives us confidence that the phenomena are real. But the larger question about a collective is also interesting, because if these things are true at the individual scale, as we see in the laboratory, it's probably also true in a much larger scale, maybe even planetary scale. So that gives rise to projects like the Global Consciousness Project, which has been going since 1998. And a few years ago, what we call GCP2 is started, and the website is gcp2.net. This is now taking our original experiment, which ended up with extremely strong evidence that something interesting was going on collectively, and expanding it quite significantly. So that experiment involved the use of electronic random number generators that were located in major cities around the world. And the underlying philosophical model was something like dual aspect monism. So dual aspect monism, again, going back to something Carl Jung had a way that he described it, was that there is an unus mundus, a one world out of which everything emerges somehow, that we don't know anything more about it other than that concept, the one world. So dual aspect monism says that one world, things can split out of it. There are aspects of it that can split, and the splitting occurs as a result of meaning. So meaning is not a physical thing. It's like a human construct at this point, but it's as close as we can get to the reason why something would emerge out of the one world. Well, the two ways that we see it most frequently is mind and matter. But because they come out of the one world, they're aspects of the same thing. So the metaphor is two sides of the same coin. It's heads and tails. They look really different if you look at it only like that. But if you pull away, you see that they're actually tightly correlated with each other. So the Global Consciousness Project is saying then that the minds of billions of people around the world are like the heads on a coin. And the physical world, the rest of it, is like the tails. They're tightly correlated with each other. But normally you wouldn't see it, because it's like you have a whole bunch of coins and you toss them and their heads and tails are all over the place. And so it's like a big, big noisy correlation. But in unusual circumstances where the mental side of the world comes together through media primarily. So if you have a billion people watching the opening ceremony of the Olympics, That's very unusual from a mental perspective. And then you would say, well, if there's that much coherence happening because everybody's paying attention to the same thing at the same time, maybe there's like a flip side, a correlation in the physical world too. And if that were the case, how would we detect that? How would we detect large-scale coherence in the physical world? So that gave rise to the use of random number generators, which by definition are completely random and don't have any patterns in them. But if it turns out that when millions of minds or billions of minds pay attention to the same thing at the same time, and these random number generators also start behaving more coherently, meaning less randomly, well, that would show the correlation that is, would be predicted by something like dual aspect monism. And that's what we found. So the next version of this, the GCP-1, the first version of this, ran for, still running actually, but it was mainly active for about 20 years. That at its peak had 75 random number generators going in major cities. The new version has about 1,000, actually a little more than 1,000 random generators running in cities around the world. And eventually we're going to work towards 4,000. So the addition of having these new generators is, first of all, there's some reasons to believe that it becomes more sensitive the more sensors, more generators that we have going. And also that the nature of the signals that we're recording are no longer just bits. Previously, we were using random bits, zeros and ones. Now we're recording the quantum noise directly. So we have, I forget if it's 12 or 16-bit analog signal, the noise signal itself out of a quantum device, and we're recording that. And the reason for doing that is because if you're working with bits, it's convenient because the devices were made to be impervious to environmental influences. So it didn't, like the temperature differences didn't matter and electromagnetic fields, all that stuff didn't matter. And we saw an interesting effect. But the next question is, well, what happened? Why did these generators change? And we have no answer to that. So the new system that we have, we're recording the noise directly, we're able to do a better job of reverse engineering to say, well, what was happening to the physics involved? What in the physical world is actually changing? So this project is still not fully operating yet. It's been underway for over a year, almost 2 years already. But we haven't built up to the full extent yet. So we're not trying to tackle this particular issue. But eventually we'll be able to. And just like in GCP-1, all the data is publicly available. So we're hoping we can attract analysts from around the world to get the data and start banging away at it to help figure out why do we see these correlations between mind and matter on the global scale. So that was a very long-winded answer to your question.
No, it's so interesting. And I believe it's like a 7-sigma result you got with the random number generators, which is pretty difficult to say happened by accident. Clearly there's something going on, and it seems like a through line of all of this is the idea that consciousness can impact or influence quantum processes. And right. Something that's been very interesting to me is this idea of what constitutes a quantum measurement, you know, using the Copenhagen interpretation. When a measurement, whatever that is made, the wave function collapses and the photon is either here or there. It can't be in both places at the same time anymore. And something that seems to be a difficult problem to grasp, particularly when we're looking in biological systems, is what constitutes a measurement? What collapses the wave function? And, you know, I thought it would be a good idea to ask you, you know, what the current understanding is about what really constitutes a measurement, a quantum measurement.
Well, as it happens, just before our interview and immediately after our interview, I'm in the midst of writing a chapter on this very topic. So it's on the top of my mind. So there's the conventional view is that a measurement, an observation slash measurement, more or less considered the same thing from physics, that it involves an interaction with a physical system. So the reason why you observe a photon and its behavior changes, like in a double slit system, is because of the interaction with this physical system of the detector. And even if you have a detector that is like a weak measurement where it just barely changes, maybe hardly changes the photon behavior at all, it's still an interaction, and that's why you see an effect. That's the conventional view. That view is probably correct in a lot of cases, but it's not completely correct. And the reason is that there's interactions called interaction-free measurement. This is the Elitzur-Waidman bomb detector method, whereby it is possible in an interferometer that if you had a bomb which was sensitive to a single photon, and therefore you can't use anything to probe it because it would blow up the moment that anything interfered with it. But is it possible to tell whether the bomb is there using an interferometer? And the answer is yes. And so the description of it is part of that original paper, and there have been a lot of discussion about it, interaction-free measurement. The other kind is one that was developed by this physicist named Renninger back in the 1950s. And his came to be known as negative outcome measurements. And so imagine that you have a double slit system and you put a detector behind one slit and you have a screen at the other side. So you shoot a single photon, it goes through a slit, the detector clicks, and then it goes on and continues on and hits the screen. So that gives you a positive measurement. You know that it went through, you gain which path information, and it collapses the wave function. But what if you shoot the photon, the detector does not click, but it hits the screen? Well, that tells you that it went through the other slit. It had to, in which case it's a negative measurement and there's no interaction at all, but you can infer that it went through the other slit because of the information that you have. That would also collapse the wave function, and which is very strange when you think about it, because there was no physical measurement at all. It's a subjective inference about what happened. So you gained information without interaction at all. So because of interaction-free and negative measurements, the idea that it must be an interaction with the physical system is simply wrong. That certainly is one explanation, but it doesn't include everything. So that opens the door a crack into, well, what if it's my mind that is observing a system? So I've been working this problem for about 15 years now in different kinds of experiments, originally using a Michelson interferometer and then double slit interferometers. And most recently, I'm writing this up now, a diffraction system, a diffraction grating. Again, an optical system. But the advantage over a double slit system is that rather than the camera looking at a kind of diffuse band of light and dark, which is the raw values that you have to work with, and it's perfectly easy to do that, but it's difficult sometimes to explain what the results are because you have to use Fourier transforms and use fringe visibility, and there are things that non-physicists may have trouble figuring out what you're talking about. So I moved over to a diffraction grating in the last experiment because if you have a transparent diffraction grating, this also works if it's a reflective, but I used transparent diffractive grating with 500 lines per millimeter and shot a red laser, 650 nanometer laser through it. And what you end up with are discrete dots of light. You have one dot that goes straight through, which is a combination of wave-like and particle-like, but then you have two dots on either side called the first order maxima on either side, and then two other dots, the second order and so on, and then further and further out. You can see the first dot, certainly the two dots on either side are dimmer, but you can see it. By the time you get to the second dots, it's pretty difficult to see with your eye. And beyond that, you really can't even see it anymore. So the interesting thing is that the first order dots, the two dots on either side of the center, only exist because of interference, because there are no photons getting shot straight through. They're there. That means that if you measure one of those side dots, it gives you a reflection of how much interference is going on in the system. So you can provide a very simple form of feedback. You could have a photo detector. In my case, I have a digital sensor, but you can have a way of looking at how much illumination there is in one of these first order dots and use that as feedback to the person, real-time feedback, how much interference is going on. And when I see the feedback, I am by association connected into the optical system. So that's then how I am consciously getting the information about what's going on inside this interference system. So as a comparison, there are also periods where I don't get feedback. So the machinery is operating constantly, right? The sensor is always measuring what's going on. But now the question is, does it matter whether I know it or not, right? I get feedback, I know what's going on. If I don't get feedback, I don't know what's going on. That's the only difference. And as I said, there are two first-order dots. So I'm getting information about one dot, but I'm not getting information about the other dot ever. But they're both being recorded. So now I can do an interesting test. So first of all, does it matter if I'm getting information or not on the dot that I was getting feedback? So there's a simple differential comparison, like how much interference is going on when I get feedback versus not. So you can show, yes, it makes a difference. What's going on in the other sensor, right? It's also recording information, but I never got any feedback about it at all. That's flat, right? There's not showing anything in that one. So you can go back and say, well, how do we understand this from the point of view of collapse of the wave function? If you look at the consciousness collapse interpretation of quantum mechanics. Well, typically the way that interpretation is described is as though it is a single event. If I shoot a photon, I gain witchcraft information, collapses, that's the end of the story. But I'm getting continual measurements. The feedback I'm getting is continual. So we need to move actually over to the quantum Zeno effect, which is more about what's happening with a continual observation, many repeated observations, which would freeze the system. Well, the system can be frozen either as this is particle-like and stays particle-like, or it's wave-like and stays wave-like. Well, in my case, I was aiming for it to freeze into the position of a particle, in which case interference would go away, because if I'm freezing the whole system into a particle, there would be no illumination of that second dot at all, because it only exists because of the wave. So when you think of the results, then you can predict that if you're getting this feedback, say for 30 seconds at a time, which is the way I set it up, and then you're not getting feedback for 30 seconds at a time, and say, well, if we look at what are we seeing in terms of the amount of interference in this system over 30 seconds if it's a quantum Zeno effect? Well, it would start out as a relatively small effect because I'm not getting full information. I'm getting kind of secondary inference. You get a little effect, but I'm continually looking at it. So it's collapsing, it's collapsing, it's collapsing, it's collapsing. I'm forcing it to remain a particle. So you get this kind of accumulation of effects over 30 seconds. And now when I'm not observing it, it should be flat because I'm not changing the thing at all. So you could look at the data in this term, get all of the many people doing the experiment, many repeated periods of observing and non-observing. What do you get? You get exactly what I just described. You show a continual drop in interference when you're getting the information, and you see flat when you don't. And so it's the most direct way I've seen so far in an experiment that shows that there is something like a quantum Zeno going on, which only involves the knowledge of the person who is getting the feedback. That pulls it away from a purely physical event into something like subjectivity is making it happen. So the next step, which I haven't done yet, but I plan to in another experiment, is to see, does it matter if I am aware of it or not? And so the way to do that would be to do either a subliminal presentation, so it's hitting my eye, but it's so dim I can't see it, or something like a mask system, so there's something interfering with my ability to understand the feedback. Or maybe false feedback. I mean, there are lots of ways of tricking the system here, so to be able to get more and more at the level of what kind of subjectivity is really necessary in order for this effect to work, and pushing it more and more towards the direction of, I think, but don't know yet at this point, is it really about consciousness, meaning conscious awareness, or is it simply about a biological system that is somehow linked into the rest of the apparatus in some way. So I have my dog look at it. Does that make a difference? You know, there are lots and lots of variations now that we can use using a system like this, because you have ways of looking at different portions of the interference pattern, some that are observed and some that are never observed. And the measurements, more importantly, are very simple to take. So that's what I'm planning to do for the next round of experiments.
That's so fascinating. I think sometimes this measurement problem is sort of explained overly simplistically, where, as soon as you become conscious of it, that's when the wave function collapsed. But it seems like there's a little bit more going on with this measurement problem than sometimes is explained. I wondered about quantum biology. So there's been a bit of discussion about whether quantum effects could occur in warm, wet environments like a body or the leaf of a plant, for instance, because there's too much going on, it's too chaotic, things are going to bump into each other, and essentially the Brownian motion style movement of the molecules in the body essentially cancel out any quantum mechanical effects, because whenever they interact, that's sort of a measurement. But, you know, we've sort of forwarded a quantum model of photosynthesis that seems to be quite well accepted now. It's been well over 10 years, and it seems like quantum processes are becoming more and more logical with our discoveries. And I guess one of the big questions coming out of this is, how do biological systems set up the conditions where quantum mechanical properties can thrive? And I've heard ideas about vibrating at the same frequency so that they start, it's like setting off a bunch of metronomes together. After a period of time, they all start lining up, or this idea of Frohlich condensates, which I'm still trying to wrap my head around. What are your thoughts on quantum processes in biology, and how do you think that might change the way we look at biology?
Well, I think it is almost certain at this point that not only is quantum mechanics operating in living systems for the same reason that it operates in every other kind of system, it's there. The question is, does it do anything? And so are there areas of the brain and the body, like microtubules, where you could have microprocesses going, and the evidence keeps moving in the direction of saying, yeah, it can sustain into matters of perhaps up to milliseconds, or at least at biologically relevant time spans. And more, I mean, I looked recently at the rise of publications in quantum biology in general, and it's an exponential rise. So even those who used to think that the brain was too hot and wet and couldn't sustain quantum coherence, that was based more or less in what we see in a physics lab. But it's missing a couple of important elements, like the brain is dynamic. And so you could have something at a femtosecond, but it is repeating itself at terahertz level, in which case, yeah, it lasts for a femtosecond, but then it's recoheres. There's also decoherence and recoherence. Both of those are possible now. So there probably is some sort of dynamic interplay going on which can sustain quantum coherence for as long as we wish. And who knows, maybe people like Stu Hameroff and Roger Penrose are correct, and that you need something like quantum coherence in order to be aware. Maybe that is the source of it. If that is true, and I think it may well be true, then suddenly the idea that we are able to have non-local perceptions, ESP kinds of things, we can start seeing a perfectly reasonable explanation for it, because part of our awareness is local senses, and part of it is not. We're connected through the universe and always have been, in which case organisms, including our own brain and body, evolved in such a way as to be fully connected with everything all the time. A lot of the time, like, we wouldn't have survived as a species unless we're paying very close attention to here and now, because otherwise it wouldn't last very long. But the connection to everything is always there. And so, again, just by thinking of it in these terms, now we have a rational, scientific, physicalist way, although not classical physics by any means, but a physicalist way of thinking about how could somebody have a mystical experience? well, and then it kind of becomes obvious that every part of you is wave-like and is connected to everything all the time. Some people have a talent for being able to drop into conditions where they're pulling away from local senses and going into whatever that other primordial sense is, where you actually don't simply have the perception of being everything, everywhere, all at once, but you actually are everywhere, all at once. And that, and of course, language fails, which is why people can't talk about it very much, but the experience can be very real. So, yeah, so will it make a difference? I think it'll make a gigantic difference. Also, we need to keep in mind that quantum mechanics is at the beginning of physics. It's not the end of physics. So when we start to discovering things like non-local or non-linear versions of quantum mechanics and multidimensional versions and so on, then the current restrictions, which don't allow signaling, will almost certainly go away. And then things like telepathy begin to make a lot of sense. And yeah, all of the other psychic kinds of effects will make a lot of sense because we'll have a more comprehensive version of quantum mechanics, which will allow for those kinds of things. So a question that comes up after this sort of discussion is, does that mean we can eventually end up with a technology? We figure out a technology to be able to use these sorts of things, and in particular, a technology that allows telepathy to be much, much better than it currently is. And I think the answer is yes. But whether that happens is going to depend on politics, not science. Because as I've often pointed out, that if you have a technology which allows for more or less perfect telepathy on demand, the whole justice system, the whole business system, politics, everything changes immediately. Because then it's not possible to lie. And people can still lie to themselves, but others can see that immediately. So what kind of a world would we live in where you didn't need courts anymore? You couldn't do business in a nefarious way. Politics, all of that, the existence of war and so on, all of that would change very dramatically. And there's a lot of pressure not to change it. There's always pressure to not change things because people have made a lot of money with the way things are. And so that's what I meant by saying that we could potentially develop methods to do that, but there would be enormous pressure to not do it, or more nefariously, to do it but keep it secret. And that would be extremely dangerous.
I couldn't agree more. And yes, it's unfortunate that science gets tangled up in politics so tightly, but it is just the way that it is.
So I would add one thing here. So yep. One of the things I talk about in this new book I'm writing is there's something like federal money, meaning all government's money used for scientific purposes, it numbers in the trillions of dollars every year. And so how much of that is devoted, at least in a public sense, to the study of the kinds of phenomena we're talking about? And the answer is zero. $0 out of trillions of dollars is being used to study these internal states, which have an enormous potential for all kinds of good and bad, but $0. Now, on a secret level, who knows? Because it's secret. I don't know how much money is being put into there. I hope some is. Hope somebody's trying to figure out what's going on here. But I think it's just so interesting that trillions of dollars, I forget exactly, I figured out one time, 2 trillion, 3 trillion, something like that, a very large number is being used for some of which is good, a big chunk going into medicine, big chunk into energy and so on. An ungodly amount is going into things like weapons. But nevertheless, there's a lot of money going to science that is devoted typically to pragmatics in some way, and to also a lot of it to basic science, and zero going towards this direction, which is just fascinating, I think.
How does your work change your thoughts about healing and how that can be done just through the mind? I know there's a lot of amazing stories about people healing just through thinking, and you know, clearly, if the kinds of things that we've been talking about are true, then there's really no barrier to that anymore, and you don't necessarily need to put something in your body to alter the chemical composition. You can do that in other ways. Is this the kind of route that you've been thinking about as far as healing can be involved in these types of phenomenon?
Yeah, I think you're talking about self-healing.
Yes.
I haven't done studies on that. We've done studies involving things like energy medicine, where you have someone who either learns how to do something or has a natural talent that has the capacity of healing someone where we don't exactly know how they're doing it. So it's somewhere between energetic and informational or field-like or something. But are they effective? The answer is yes. They can be very effective. They're not effective on everything, but some things, especially like pain and some kinds of neurological problems, can be healed by somebody who from a distance looks like they're doing nothing. But clearly something is happening. So we're trying to figure out what is it? What do they do? So we find correlates like use of random number generators in a healing context. It's in the background. It's running. Is anything happening? Yeah, we find repeatedly that during something like a half an hour healing session, whether it's Reiki or some other method like that, the random generators stop behaving randomly, suggesting there's just something like coherence occurring, being arisen in some way. And the person, typically in a big experiment we did, involves carpal tunnel pain, very significant improvement in it, which persisted as a result of this half an hour of 17 different kinds of healing modalities. Yeah, people got better significantly. And random number generators changed. And water, which we had the healer and the client wear in a little aliquot around their neck, the water significantly changed its structure. We used spectroscopy to look at the water structure, and it changed. So something energetic or informational happens, and there is a physical effect that we can see in the environment that looks, for want of a better term, like coherence happened. That almost doesn't even make sense, those words, except that something, some sort of coherence arose in the environment that, and apparently also in the client or the patient, and so they got better. So what your question is asking is, well, can you do that yourself? Most of the healers that I know, these energetic healers or people doing mental kind of healing, they don't have very much luck healing themselves, at least not with the methods that they've learned. The closest to that I've seen are methods like EFT, like emotional freedom technique, the tapping method. I've used that sometimes, and then I forget about it a long time. And then I have an issue, like my blood pressure feels high. And I remember, oh, I could use that. And I do it. And it's like miraculous. Like, holy smoke, what just happened here? I did some silly thing involving tapping. And within minutes, it changes. What I interpret from that is unconsciously, I've been doing something to like create hypertension. And through the use of that particular method, I'm telling my unconscious, cut it out. Just stop it. Don't do that anymore. And it responds. And now I don't have hypertension anymore. I mean, a matter of minutes. So is it possible? Yes. A lot of it, I think, is a lot of health problems are mediated by what's going on in the unconscious, which by definition, we're not aware of. So if you can get ways of getting beyond that, and that's, I think, why things like hypnosis work, maybe auto-hypnosis, methods like that. Yeah, they can be really effective if you can bypass these conscious loops that are somehow causing an internal problem and get your unconscious to work on it. Because if we see in the laboratory that my intention will affect something elsewhere, I can just use the same process on myself and physically change what's going on, even though I may not know literally what to do. I'm not sure what I would know if I was conscious about it. What do I change in my body to lower blood pressure? Well, sort of imagine I'm doing something to blood vessels and so on, but I don't know in detail. But maybe my unconscious does because it's involved in the way that my body is working. So I can talk directly to my unconscious and saying, okay, just stop what you're doing there and go back into a normalized condition. And it does that, boom, I'm fixed.
You mentioned water there before. I know Jerry Pollack. I've spoken to him a few times. I'm going to be hanging out with him in a couple of weeks, actually. And I wonder, you know, there's a lot of anomalous properties of water, and of, by molecular count, we're basically entirely water. Do you think water is basically the medium or a medium through which some of these effects are mediated?
Yeah, that I don't know. I know that it reflects changes, certainly. And it, yes, given that we either have HTO in one form or another almost everywhere in our body, it is probably involved in some way, but how it would be involved is another issue, right? We see correlations. We see some changes in water structure and some of the bonds. At this point, we don't know how to make the connection from one thing to the other. It's just that, yeah, there's a correlation.
Another thing that really interested me and has interested me for a long time is tarot and astrology. A lot of people tend to, I think, throw the baby out with the bathwater on this topic. And I was wondering what your thoughts on these things are. I know Carl Jung took them quite seriously, and I think there is something to be gained from taking them seriously as well. Do you think tarot and astrology can be helpful in sort of navigating your way through the world?
Well, tarot and astrology, both as divination techniques, are, and the way that I view it is, externalized ways of engaging your unconscious, which is where most of these interesting phenomena are happening, symbolically. So some people are really good at using tarot cards, and then they interpret the symbols. And they, of course, you can learn the techniques of astrology and the meanings of the symbols and so on. But the really good people who are practiced at this and are highly intuitive, I don't think they're not reading the book, right? They're not just reciting back what the symbols mean. Like if you're using a computer program, it's more like an astrological chart becomes a mandala, and the symbols in tarot and the symbols in I Ching and all of the other methods that are used, they become ways of engaging some aspect of your insight or intuition in a way that pulls together partially what you got from the technique, almost like a remote viewing. Like it's an entree, it's a doorway into an aspect of yourself where you're able to get that information. And eventually, I would suspect that if you train somebody in all of the divination methods, because they have lots of similarities among the different methods, that they would eventually learn that they don't need it at all. You don't need the tea leaves, and you don't need the tarot. You don't need any of that stuff. What you do, what you need, is to switch into some kind of mind state where you just get it. And so, and I know this from people I know who are really expert at remote viewing, right? You can take your remote viewing training and you go through all the methods and all the stuff. Eventually, you don't need that anymore. The same is true in the magical traditions about enchantment. So you can do a sigil, you can do knot magic, you can do word magic, you can do ceremonial magic. Eventually, you don't need to do any of that because you recognize the internal switch, essentially, that is required to get into the state where you do it directly. So I'm not saying that these are crutches. I'm saying that they're ways of learning, like you would put training wheels on a bicycle. They're very valuable when you begin, and then you use the bike soap plow, and then it becomes unconscious, all of the mechanisms involved, and you don't really need it anymore, unless you believe that you needed it. If you believe that you need the tarot deck to do the tarot thing, well, of course, you need it then. But what I'm saying is that you can advance through that, and eventually you don't need it at all.
That's such a fascinating way to look at it. I've often thought about that with biodynamics and regenerative agriculture. It might just be a way of bringing your intention to the right place, which is doing all the work in the first place, but that's sort of a framework with which to get you there. Right. Very interesting. I'm very conscious of your time, and I've got a million more questions I want to ask you, but we'll have to save that for another time, I think. Thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I know how busy you must be, so I really appreciate it. And this has been, I'm just so grateful. It's been wonderful.
Good. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. I've left links to all of Dean's books below. I strongly recommend reading them, particularly Supernormal and Real Magic. Please feel free to subscribe to the podcast, as it really helps me grow the channel and get more incredible guests to speak with. I also have a Substack that I use to go even deeper into these podcast topics and offer my personal thoughts and ideas. Again, this is the best way to keep on track with my work while also supporting the podcast and keeping it going. I've left links below where you can follow me on social media, where I share a lot of health-related information. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.